I looked at this passage when I realized I was preaching this week, and I said to Ryan, I'm not preaching. However, having spent 3 weeks studying, I'm now about to give you all the answers you will need to answer any questions your children ask you during coffee hour or at home. Amen. I found this passage particularly difficult for several reasons. One, it has some very difficult and harsh-sounding words in it. Secondly, I believe it's also a passage that has been used at times to make most of us, if not all of us, feel like utter failures as followers or disciples. Another reason that I have found it difficult is that it's one of those passages that I believe has been used more than upon one occasion to do what I call froth up the energy of being a follower. Now, there's only one problem with frothing people up. The froth dies down, and often we're left wondering, why do I even bother wanting to be a follower? Is it even worth it? And the last problem I had with it, amongst many others, which I shall not go into, is that I found a way of looking at it that I actually really liked, but it causes some more problems, and I'll talk about more of that later on. So join with me this morning as I unpack some of the struggles and issues in this passage, and may God help us to understand what Jesus was saying, what he was not saying, and what in heaven's name does it mean for us here in FBC in 2010. The context is that Jesus, for some time now in Luke, has been alerting his disciples to the fact that he is headed to Jerusalem and to suffering and death. The problem, of course, was that that part of his message was overshadowed by his healings, his miracles, his casting out of demons, and this radically new and fresh teaching that he gave about who God was. So in spite of the fact that he had looked ahead and was trying to warn all who followed him that it was a way of suffering and potential death, he had these large crowds starting to follow him. And then he gives what I call this little gem of a speech. If anyone comes to me and does not hate mother, father, wife, children, and even life itself, you cannot follow me. Whoever does not carry their cross and follow me cannot be my follower. Those who do not give up everything you have cannot be my follower. These statements have a lot of what I will call the ouch factor in them. And what is he doing here, for heaven's sakes? I mean, after all, this is the man who spoke about love and loving even your enemies. And now he's telling people to hate their family and even them, their very lives. He gets a crowd and a good hearing, and it's as if he stops and says, I want them all to go away, so I'm going to make this really tough teaching for them. So first, let me unpack this hate your family and your very life yourself. Now, this is the man who spoke about honoring your parents, loving your enemy, loving God and your neighbor, and now this. Well, the first thing that helps is to realize that this word hate actually means detach from, and it does not have the same emotional impact that we hear when someone says to us, I hate you. So this word actually does not mean that we are to despise and reject our family. It actually is about detachment from. So it's something quite different than an emotionally laden, you are to hate them. You may hate your family for your experience with them, but that has absolutely nothing to do with following God. This is about leaving behind so that you can move on to something else. One of my old bosses used to say, you cannot say hello to something new unless you have said goodbye well to what has been. Married people understand this, and we have some newly married people in the audience out there. I think I saw the Barkmans. Married people understand this. It's about this process of leaving your family of origin so that you can cleave to start a new life with someone else. Let me give an example out of my own life that I think will help unpack this a little bit for you. When I worked for InterVarsity, I loved my job. You know, it was about all those good things like saving the world and changing the world and doing God's work. It was wonderful. And whenever I went to Calgary, I used to stay with my brother and his family. And one time when I was staying there, I was, as usual, late for dinner. And when I came in and apologized and sat down with them, my brother looked at me and he said, "We always know that if you have a choice between InterVarsity and us, we always come second." Ouch. Now, I thought about that actually for years, to tell you the truth. It's still vivid in my mind. And you might think I actually had figured out how to detach from family and love God first. But I actually knew that that's not what was going on. I cared more about how my InterVarsity colleagues thought of me than I did what my family thought of me. I wanted the affirmation and the recognition from my InterVarsity colleagues than I actually did from my family. I spent years trying to figure out what it meant to meet my emotional needs through God loving me rather than having a deep need for others to love me. So it might have looked like I had figured out how to detach from family, but that actually was not what was happening. I realized that God had to be at work first, and then I had at least a chance of loving others as he had loved me. This phrase, hating one's very life. There is an approach in Christian circles, and I call it, and it has been called, worm theology. And I actually think that there's an old hymn somewhere that the title is, "I am nothing, nothing, nothing." I am a worm, and I realize this, and by getting myself there, I more nearly approach the give up your life so that you may save it. We condemn ourselves of being of no worth, a failure at being a follower. I have one word for that theology or understanding: balderdash. That was the politest word I could think of to share with you in public. I use it once more. We are deeply loved by God. We are of tremendous worth to God. He sent his son for us. There is no value in self-punishment other than pain, and God does not ask this of us. Next, this difficult phrase, carry one's own cross. Well, let's get one thing clear right off the bat. The cross that needed carrying, that was about saving the world, has already been carried, and it was carried by Jesus. And we do not need to carry that cross. Yes, following can involve risk and sacrifice, but we are not being asked to save the world. That has been done, and it is not our job. Cross carrying also does not mean that we have to take everything that life throws at us, chronic pain, suffering, illness, death of a loved one, and somehow with a wonderful Christian smile on our face, bear it all. After all, I'm carrying my cross, and make sure you keep the smile on your face. This is about believing that in suffering we somehow grow closer to God and understand Christ's suffering. There is even a thought out there that God causes all of this so that we might learn and grow from it. And remember, keep the smile on. Not to say that one cannot learn from suffering, but for every moment of learning, there are other moments that destroy. May I say again, balderdash. Suffering for suffering's sake does not get us closer to God, nor is it a pattern that is valued and affirmed in scriptures. We follow a God who is committed to healing, wholeness, and well-being. Pain or difficulties are not God's cross for us to bear. They are truly pain and suffering and are worth mourning. They are not a part of God's plan to strengthen his followers. Let me quote from one of the comments I read on the website Working Preacher. Actually, Ryan found this one for me. We have been trained somewhere to think that when Jesus talks about taking up our cross, he's referring to some major spiritual travail, or at least some significant suffering or sacrifice, preferably on behalf of the faith. But what if it's simpler than that? What if it's more ordinary? This is what Alan Culpepper says. The language of cross-bearing has been corrupted by overuse. Bearing a cross has nothing to do with chronic pain, illness, trying family circumstances, and relationships. It is instead what we do voluntarily as a consequence of our following Christ. If this is true, we are invited to take up our cross, that is, have our life shaped by our commitment to Christ, anywhere, anytime, and doing just about anything. Voters, volunteers, interior decorators, teachers, managers, temporary workers, retired workers, bus drivers, barbers, students or secretaries, parents or payroll officers. All these people, all of us, when we offer our lives, our time, our talent, and our labor to God, are bearing our cross by allowing the whole of our lives to be shaped by our commitment to Christ. One of the problems with this passage was that every commentary I read had a different opinion on it, and here's just a few of them. Some believe that this is a challenge to our complacency, some that it's a wake-up call, some that it's about establishing our priorities, some that following is actually about suffering, some that it's a call to set our priorities, some that it's a call to freely give or use all that we have to care for those in need. I'm just not quite sure what we're supposed to do when we've used all that we have to care for those in need. I guess we become those in need and someone else is supposed to care for us. One commentator even put it this way: our love of Jesus must be so great that all other earthly loves become hate. I definitely don't like that one. Another one, that this is actually a call to separate followers and disciples. If you're really serious, you're a disciple, and if you can't quite hack it, you're a follower. I don't like that one either. However, in each of those, there were some helpful glimpses. There were some points that were somewhat useful. However, the approach that I found that I really liked was from a British theologian, N.T. Wright, in a small commentary called Luke for Everyone. And this is what he says. We need to look at this passage as the rallying cry of a great leader who knows that his people are facing a huge challenge. And after some thought, I realized this is what Winston Churchill, the British Prime Minister during World War II, did as Britain faced war. He knew they were neither emotionally nor practically ready to face the war. This was a country that still remembered and was suffering from the horrors and the loss of World War I. This is what he said in his very first speech as Prime Minister in the House of Commons, and they were already at war. I would say to the House, as I have said to those who joined this government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many long months of struggle. You ask, what is our policy? I say it is to wage war with all our might, with all the strength God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny, never before surpassed in the dark, lamentable catalog of humankind. You ask, what is our aim? Victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of terror, victory however long and hard the way. Why? For without victory, there is no survival. He said this immediately after the emergency evacuation of the bulk of the British Army and the French Army from Dunkirk, surrounded by the Germans and leaving all of their equipment that an army needs to be an army on the roads and the beaches of Dunkirk. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence in the air. Whatever the cost, we shall fight on the beaches and the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And this is what Wright believes is happening in this passage, that it's the rallying cry of a leader as he realizes his people are facing a great challenge. Now, this is my problem with that. We actually don't live where this passage was written. We are not living as a country occupied by an oppressive ruler. We are not living with a despotic king as Herod was. We are not living with crosses beside the roads, which would have been normal then as a punishment for anyone who disobeyed. We live here in Edmonton, in Canada, in 2010. People are not dying. We are not facing the kinds of things that these people faced. So what in heaven's name are we to do with this passage? Well, I decided after all that reading and studying that, simply put, this passage is about following. Now, you're sitting there thinking, Tanya, you could have told us that at the beginning and saved a whole pile of words. That is what the passage says. But let me unpack that a little bit more. Ryan has been saying to us for some time now that following is about radical generosity, radical welcoming, and radical forgiving. As I was preparing for this, I read a book called Tea with Hezbollah, almost called the sermon title Tea with Hezbollah. And this book was written by two men, Ted and Carl. And it all started when one of them asked the other, what do Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Jesus have in common? What do Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and Jesus all have in common? The other guy said, they were all murdered. And he observed that they were murdered for basically the same message, that love of one's neighbor is critical, and even if one's neighbor is one's enemy. And so they asked the question, is it possible to love one's enemy? And so this is what these two men did. They said, let's find out if anyone believes that this radical teaching is still possible in the year 2010. They said, let's go to some of the United States' so-called enemies and ask them whether they think this is possible. And then let's write this so that Americans can sit and be at a table with our enemies and also ask that question, can we love our enemies? Carl said, does that mean we're going to the Middle East? And Ted said, not just the Middle East. Let's go and interview Hamas, Hezbollah, the greatest minds and teachers in the Islamic world now. After all, Muslims revere Jesus, who gave us this teaching in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Ted, so we go to some of our greatest enemies. We're talking about one of the most complicated regions in the world, brimming with violence, huge divides between Muslims, Jews, and Christians, bombs, terrorism, massive loss of life. They realized that they needed to do this because the events in the people of the Middle East are crucial to every human's future, whether we know it or not. And that's what they did. They flew into Lebanon one day after one of their many wars had ended. They visited Syria, Saudi Arabia, the West Bank, the divided city of Jerusalem, and they even went to the north of Israel where they found, because they found out that there were a remnant of Samaritans still alive. 700 of them. And at the end of the book, they ask this question, what did we learn? And this is what they learned. No one, Christian, Jew, or Muslim, seems to believe that one can love one's enemies. They are all guilty, regardless of religion. Over here, Christians are known as much for violence as the next guy. Is the teaching of Jesus impossible? They found two people only who were trying to love their enemies. And one of them says, I would agree with Sami Awad and Dr. Micah. It's as hard today as it was 2,000 years ago. As hard as it is, King, Gandhi, and their mentor Jesus all knew one thing. It is the only solution. Then he asks his friend, "Does that mean you're a pacifist now?" And he answers, "No, I don't know what I am with respect to the government's use of power, but one-on-one love is the only solution, and nobody does it well. Not Christians, not Muslims, not Jews, not me." Radical generosity, radical welcome, radical forgiveness. Sounds like a recipe for radical love, even if it is for one's enemy. Now, this is a challenge that we need a rallying cry for. Is it not worth trying and taking a few risks to see if this is possible? Trying in spite of failure, disaster, wrong turns? Not in the Middle East. That'd be too easy for us to think about. But right here, with the people we worship with the people we live with in our families, with our friends, with our colleagues, with those who drive us nuts, with organizations who have hurt and abused us. Is this not worth trying? Will we get it? Of course not. It's a process. The move to radical love takes a lifetime of trying, but I would believe it is better to try and fail every once in a while, or often, than never to have tried at all. The consequences could be rather spectacular. It would be interesting to see what the consequences would be. Would this become a place that was known for its radical love? I personally do not think we're there yet. I know I'm not. Otherwise, when disasters happen, there would be articles written about this church and its incredible response. Otherwise, we would all experience that as we come with each other. However, if we do not try, what will the answer be? I don't know, and I don't think that's the question that we need to ask. But I do believe that the one we say we follow is calling us to try in our own bumbling and somewhat inept way to follow this call to radical love, to do battle with our own instincts and the world's pressure to ignore Jesus, and particularly his radical teaching to love one's enemy, by being generous, forgiving, and welcoming. He names the risks and the challenge, but he calls us. The one who calls us to this way of radical love, who calls that we let our everyday lives be cross-shaped, he knows that this is a process, and he assures us that he will be with us. He calls that we would follow and not let the process with its bumps, mistakes, and messiness discourage us. That's a lot of stuff. Let me give you a moment to reflect in silence, and I will close with a kind word from God from Isaiah. Give yourself a few moments to think. Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be afraid, for I am your God. I will strengthen you, and I will help you. I will uphold you with my victorious right hand. Amen.